Chapter 17. Birdland, 8 months ago. The offices of Mendel, Panofsky, and Levine sprawled over the entire 47th floor of a solid glass skyscraper just below Central Park. One of the top art and entertainment law firms in the country, there was no art hung on the walls, just blank expanses of white and glass windows with killer views of downtown Manhattan. The receptionist, pale blonde hair, wearing a white sheath and white pumps, ushered him into the conference room. 5 minutes later, Kim Wok was shaking his hand. She was short, barely over 5 feet tall, her silver hair cut short in a bob, wearing a beautifully tailored dark blue suit, dark pumps, and a crisp white shirt. She came at him smiling, hand extended. He had the impression that she should be wearing glasses. Her teeth were very square and white. It was 2 weeks after the Marx's visit, and he was back in New York, booked to play a recital of Bieber's Rosary Sonatas at Hunter College. Aunt Rochelle had found him several attorneys to advise him on the Marx situation, and one of them was in New York, so he made an appointment for a consultation. Now he repeated how Andrea Marx had written him several letters, and then how she and her brother Dante had appeared on his doorstep. As he spoke, he felt almost physically ill. Andrea Marx's chicken waddle swayed gently in front of him. In the slightly distasteful way Dante held out the $200,000 check, refused to leave his mind.
"So, let me get this straight," Kim said when he'd finished. "These two people show up unannounced, read you some letter off their phone, and tell you they're taking a $10 million Stradivarius? And you're worried about this?"
He shrugged. "I'm just telling you what happened. Do you think there's a case?"
"On the face of it, not much," Kim said. "Stolen property cases are pretty clear. The Marxes will have a lot to prove."
She thought a moment, then ticked off on her fingers.
"First, they're going to have to prove that the violin was actually theirs. It's easy enough to say that they had a violin and you have a violin, but they need to prove that their family's violin is actually yours."
Ray nodded. "Okay, I can see that."
"Assuming they can prove that the violin is the same one, they're going to have to show that it was actually stolen. Did they supply any kind of proof that your ancestor actually stole it?"
Ray shook his head. "My grandma always said that Pop-Pop was given the violin, that the slave owner, who might actually have been Pop-Pop's father, gave it to him."
"The claim seems very far-fetched, honestly. I bet that's why they went to you directly instead of hiring a lawyer. They hoped they could intimidate you."
"So you're saying I shouldn't worry?"
"If it were me, I wouldn't stay awake worrying about it. They might try filing a claim against you, just so you'll settle with them instead of going to court, but I don't think you're there yet."
"Settle?" Ray said.
"How?"
"They don't want money. They want the violin."
Kim shrugged. "We don't know what they want. Maybe they want you to sell the violin and split the proceeds."
"Well, that's not happening."
"That's why I told you not to worry. You're not there yet. At this point, I would ignore them. Don't answer their letters."
"And I sure as hell am not inviting them over for a cookout," Ray said.
She laughed. "Yeah, I doubt they'd bring wine."
"So you think I'm okay?"
"From what you've told me and what I've seen, that's what I think. Plus, think of the optics. Slaveholder's family making a claim against their former slave's family. It doesn't get more bizarre than that, especially in today's world where reparation claims are being made by the descendants of enslaved people against the slaveholder. Go play your violin and stop worrying."
She looked over at the violin.
"Can I see it?"
"Of course," he said, opening the case. She duly admired the violin, and he closed the case again, as if not wanting the violin to hear the uproar it had caused. With a lighter heart, he left the white office and the stunning view and returned to the grimy New York City streets. A yellow and red gyro stand on the corner of 53rd and 6th smelled amazing, so he ordered falafel and rice with extra white sauce and headed uptown to Hunter College. He had to admit that he liked being out in the world by himself,
playing whatever music he felt like playing. He liked jazz clubs and now sought out more of them to keep playing, even when he didn't have classical performances scheduled. He loved the showmanship of the French-Italian jazz violinist Stéphane Grappelli, the loose, easy elegance of how the Frenchman would throw out a musical sentence and pick it up again, always seeming cool and utterly engaged. Ray wanted to do that, to bring enjoyment to anyone who would listen. When he'd first tried his hand at jazz, it was a mess. Like most classically trained musicians who relied on strict training, he was most comfortable following the roadmap that a composer laid out. Ray would pour himself onto the classical route, which had clear signposts and a yellow line down one side. With jazz, there were no signs. The GPS just said, "Go." Jazz charts provided a simple melody he was just supposed to riff from. He wanted to read every note, lock in on each finger pattern. How would he even begin? He started by listening to the opening melody of a song, then adding a few notes in the same key, then changing the key for a while, then somehow miraculously returning to the original key, all while making it seem effortless. This took a lot of practice. When he thought he had it, he had to think again. It was fun, challenging, and exercised new muscles in his playing. Janice would not have been pleased. Ray was moving up in the world of violin performance, and, in her view, he had to make his mark in the classical realm, not dabble in jazz. Doing both would mean that Ray had too many irons in the fire. Nonetheless, in New York City, he always made time for the legendary Birdland Jazz Club, sitting in on the jazz combos when they'd let him. The first few times were a bit rough. He'd played a jazzy, bluesy, minor Dorian mode instead of a major Mixolydian mode. But he hadn't cared, and the other musicians hadn't either. Each session improved, and soon he was jamming with several regular standards under his belt. New York City, Ray found, had many drawbacks. Crowds, an often confusing and daunting subway system, high prices for food, lodging, travel. But all the drawbacks were worth it, Ray decided, as he looked out at Birdland's audience, glowing in the red candle holder's dim light. New York City women were, without question, beautiful. Check out the left wall, the tawny-haired woman with the tight dress running her fingers suggestively around her wine glass, or the high-cheekboned black woman sitting with a pimply-faced guy at a table two back from the stage. And those were just the people who leaped out at him. There were dozens more, here and out on the street. Pity that none of them seemed to want to get to know him beyond buying him a drink between sets, or asking for his autograph outside the stage door, or having a conversation that started with anything other than, "How long have you been playing?" The attractive women who seemed to take an interest in him were mostly in the look but don't touch category, and things almost always stopped at looking. Was it them? Was it him? It was probably him. He looked the part, but had zero game. He'd been a loner all his life, with few close friends, and that hadn't changed much. He'd imagined the musician's life would be filled with gorgeous women. This might have been the case for huge rock and roll stars, but thus far, in Ray's classical and limited jazz experience, he was more likely to trip over a microphone cord than to have an admiring fan invite him for a drink and slip him her room key. So after the Birdland performance, when a tall, slender woman with an extravagant hairdo approached him, he thought he'd struck gold. She wasn't really his type. Her hair, curled elaborately, was clipped with barrettes and dazzled with glitter. Her makeup, too, overwhelmed. It looked like someone had loaded a box of crayons into a gun and fired it onto her face. And oh, her outfit. Her white pants looked spray-painted onto her very long, slender legs, and her crop top, about a size and a half too small, was the brightest shade of electric blue that had ever been manufactured. In her yellow and white high heels, she towered over him. But she was smiling at him, really smiling. He could see her back molars. She was seriously into him. He didn't even register what she was saying until she touched his arm. "Hey, Ray Ray, you look so good. You look just like your uncle."
Uncle? Now he was totally confused.
Hey, what up? How you doing?
It took him a minute to realize that she wasn't into him after all. She was into his uncle, figured.
"Oh, I'm all right. I was visiting my cousin in Newark, and I just caught the train over to see you."
She cradled her oversized suede handbag, rocking it back and forth. It was big enough to hold a small Rottweiler.
"Your uncle said you was playing here tonight. Did I miss it?"
Finally, it clicked. This was Uncle Thurston's girlfriend, Lashana. He'd only met her once in person, although she'd been equally resplendent then.
"Oh, that's nice," he said. "Sorry you missed the show. How's Uncle Thurston?"
"He's good," she said. "You want to grab a drink? Catch up?"
He eyed the door.
"That would be awesome, but I've got to get back to the hotel. Early flight tomorrow."
"Oh," she said, clearly disappointed. "The thing is, Thurston had told me to come see you since I was so close. I have a little favor to ask."
Ray waited.
"Thurston said I should ask you for a small loan."
Ray bit his lip.
"Oh, wow. I really don't have any money to spare. I'm pretty much tapped out. Did he tell you that most of my money goes to him and my other aunts and uncles? And my mom, of course."
"Yeah, he said you was gonna say something like that. Ray Ray, we know you got money. You know I'm just like your auntie. You gonna hook me up?"
"Look, I'll talk to Uncle Thurston, okay? That's the best I can do. I hope you have a safe trip back to Newark. I'm sorry you came all this way for nothing."
Before he could change his mind, but how could he change his mind since he didn't have the money? He slipped away and left the club, zipping down into the subway stop on the corner. Next day, when Uncle Thurston texted him, "Got a sec?" Ray didn't reply. Over the next couple days, Uncle Thurston tried calling and texting, and Ray ignored them all. He was furious that Uncle Thurston would put him in such a position with his girlfriend. He still kept sending his uncle and the rest of Grandma Nora's children money when he could. Outside the family drama with the Marx's bizarre claim seemingly laid to rest, Ray was able to concentrate on music and began booking performances for early the following year. In February, Black History Month, he was booked solid, back to back, every night. He wasn't good enough to play with certain orchestras during the other 11 months of the year, but would shine in February, where he would play composers like Samuel Coleridge Taylor and William Grant Still. Still's Suite for Violin and Piano was always a crowd pleaser. Ray was honored to bring music composed by people who looked like him to people who knew nothing about him. The most challenging thing about February was finding a pianist who could actually play the parts. It wasn't regular old Beethoven. It was Beethoven on steroids. As he continued to schedule, a pattern began to emerge that became clear during a call with the Delaware Valley Philharmonic's music director. They were going over an upcoming program.
"We were hoping you'd be really excited about our Gershwin review," the woman said.
"I'm sorry, but why would I be excited about a Gershwin review?" Ray asked, genuinely curious. Perhaps they were just enamored with Gershwin, had a unique arrangement or a new adaptation.
"Well, it's Gershwin."
"Okay, and?"
"We just thought that you would really like to play Gershwin."
"And why would you think that?" Ray was trying to remember if he'd ever given an interview or ever said anything to anyone about his secret Gershwinian fixation. Nothing came to mind. So he'd asked the question to honestly see if she could jog his memory.
"I just have a hunch that you'd really like to play that kind of music."
"Oh," he said, finally understanding. "Right.
He realized that, in the director's eyes, he would play Gershwin because he was black, and because black people were not sophisticated enough to master, nor in many instances even capable of mastering, the real European composers like Beethoven, Bach, Corelli, Mozart, Mendelssohn, or Brahms. Only people who look like dead white composers would actually interpret them effectively. A week after the Gershwin call, Ray was setting up via video call a performance for the Big Rock Symphony Orchestra in Big Rock, South Carolina.
"We're quite excited for you to do a performance of some of your music," said a pudgy spokesperson for the board of directors.
"I'm sorry. I don't quite understand," Ray said, fearing that he did indeed understand.
"We are trying to promote diversity throughout our organization. We believe that Big Rock leads South Carolina in being inclusive, so that's why we feel it would be best if we feature someone like you, who plays music he is familiar with."
"Oh," Ray said. "I get it."
"So glad we're on the same page," the man said.
The skin under his jaw jiggled. Ray couldn't see his neck.
"That shit is dope, yo," he told them. "I fucks with some Mendelssohn. I'ma rock that shit. Playing them arpeggios and shit is my jam. Can't wait to come. Anything but that Gershwin shit, yo. Every time I turn around, somebody be trying to get me to play that fake black shit."
Sufficiently stunned, the board of directors of the Big Rock Symphony knew not what to say nor where to look. Their eyes were all downcast, as if deeply engrossed by something slightly below the camera.
"Now that I have your attention," Ray went on, "I need you to understand something. I am a musician. I happen to be black. That doesn't mean that I am any less skilled or knowledgeable than any musician of any other race. You might want to invest in some diversity training rather than paying for a soloist. Get your act together, and I may come and play for you one day. Best of luck." He left the meeting. In the meantime, his following was growing. A group at Northwestern University had developed a webpage dedicated to him that had more than 600,000 hits. The comments ranged from, "You are an inspiration," to, "If you ever come to Oklahoma, look me up." Ray had become a minor celebrity, especially within college circles. He was the cool classical guy who could play jazz and everything else. Only 8 months until the Tchaikovsky competition, and Ray was determined not only to apply, but to win. The competition, founded in the 1950s and held every 4 years, was a cross between the Olympics and American Idol. It streamed live to more than 5 million classical music diehards who could rapidly vote for their favorite in various phases of the contest. Classical luminaries, a mix of musicians and conductors, served as judges. Although the competition should be judged just on musical prowess, and certainly a wrong note or a flubbed phrase could destroy a contestant's chances, Ray realized soon enough that, like all the other broadcast competitions, popularity with the audience could be a huge factor. Luque de Bargue, for instance, the self-taught pianist with brilliant blue eyes, was discovered while working in a grocery store. He won both judges' and audiences' hearts with flair and showmanship. Ray wanted to win, but felt like he had several hurdles to overcome if he got accepted to compete. First, he had to really up his game as a musician, and he was working on that. He and Janice were lining up expert teachers, specialists in Bach, Mozart, Tchaikovsky, and the like, to drill him on the repertoire. Second, he was an American in a competition dominated by Asians and Europeans. Nothing he could do about that. Last, he worried that he was only a performer and not much of a showman. He wanted the audience not to just connect with his music, but to remember him, to really engage with him on a deeper level. Luque de Bargue had been able to do this, and Ray thought he should as well. Showmanship wasn't Janice's forte. Like Ray, she was a performer.
So he started asking the various concertmasters, musicians, and conductors he played with for suggestions on who he could talk to about upping his showmanship game. Fellow musicians gave him names, so he internet stalked them. One name kept reappearing, Christoph von Korden. Christoph was a German musical prodigy who had played concerts all over Europe by the time he was six. After several years as first violin in the Berlin Philharmonic, considered one of the very best orchestras in the world, he burned out and turned to conducting, eventually landing a position as conductor for the Netherlands Philharmonic Orchestra for 3 years. He was known as a showman, spending hours focusing on production value, bright colored lights, elaborate costumes, and staging. Audiences loved him. He made the music dramatic, compelling, interesting, and fun. Back in August, Ray had filled out the Tchaikovsky competition's multiple forms, sent documentation, photographs, recommendation letters, lists of repertoire, performance schedules, and a video performance, all to prove his worthiness. Now, the last week in September, as he was checking his email right before he headed out to play a recital at Georgetown University, a new email awaited him from the directorate of the competition. Dear Mr. Raekwon McMillan, we are pleased to inform you that... That's all Ray needed to read. He was in. Euphoria made his head swim. He called Janice, who offered to reach out to specific teachers and help coordinate his lessons with them. In the meantime, he'd make sure all of his performing repertoire would be the same musical pieces he'd be playing in the competition, so each performance would also serve as a means of practicing in front of an audience. Now he needed to up his showmanship. As soon as his plane touched down at Reagan National Airport, Ray emailed Christoph. What did he have to lose? Chapter 18. Demands. 7 months ago. 2 weeks later, Ray was playing at the filled-to-capacity Joseph Meyerhoff Symphony Hall, the audience buzzing about the phenom with the Strad. The first half of the recital was Brahms and Mozart. He played Brahms' Sonata No. 3 in D minor so passionately that he almost turned to his local accompanist to beg her to give him more support from the piano. She was a good pianist, but had a very hard time keeping up with him. Then he dove into the Mozart. The first movement was smooth and flawless, building to the second movement. The pianist was doing her best to anticipate his rubatos, but Ray kept cranking up the emotion to new heights. The third movement took off like a racehorse, Ray pushing the pianist. The notes flew by, and this time she didn't disappoint, building to a final retard into the last two measures that left them all breathless. The audience roared its approval. At the end of the recital, when Ray had apparently signed every program, a short balding man in his mid-70s approached them. He wore a stained navy blazer with a red carnation in the lapel. "Hi," Ray said automatically. "Thank you for coming. Hope you enjoyed the show." "You need Mutzwerk," the man told him in a heavy German accent. "Excuse me?" "I believe you heard me. You people are good at a lot of things, but not this. I may be able to fix you, but it depends on how well you listen." "What did you just say?" "Who the hell are you?" "I am Christoph von Korden," said the man. "But I haven't hired you yet." "I know. I live not far from here, and wanted to watch you before I agreed to provide you with coaching. You are extremely rough, but I will agree to do this for 3 months. Then we will see what we will see." Christoph quite clearly was a bigoted ass, but Ray had dealt with people like that all his life, Uncle Roger and the Wedding Ensemble debacle being one of the most memorable. It was just something you did as a black person. You learned to overlook the insults in order to get what was more important to you. And right now, the Tchaikovsky competition was more important. Christoph was a grade-A musician, a grade-A showman, and a grade-F human being. Ray could live with the compromise. They went to a local coffee shop to hash out the details of Christoph's tutelage. Christoph had very large, very light blue eyes that he would blink slowly at Ray, as if disbelieving or disapproving of everything Ray said. They agreed to try a month and see how the situation developed. That evening, after Ray left Christoph and returned to his hotel, Uncle Larry emailed.
Hello, Ray. I hope you are well. I'm sorry I missed your performance with the symphony here. I'm sure it was fantastic. I'm writing to thank you again for the money you've been sending. Really nice of you. Can you give me a shout? It's important.
When Ray called, Uncle Larry picked up on the first ring. After they chatted for a few minutes, Larry's voice got serious.
So, the reason I wanted to talk to you is that a really great opportunity, really great, just dropped into my lap. I got a tip on a bunch of high-end restaurant fixtures going dirt cheap. It's what I've been waiting for. It'll mean I can finally open my own place.
That's great, Ray said warily.
So I wondered, with all the money you're making these days, if I could get a little loan, just to cover the costs.
Oh, wow, Uncle Larry. It'd really help me out. I don't have any more money, Ray said. Every gig I get, I divide and send to all of you. I don't have anything saved up.
Yeah, I figured, Larry said easily. But you know, you can get a loan on my mama's fiddle. I checked with the bank. They'll use it as collateral.
I don't know about. It's really easy. I already talked to a bank, and I can set everything up from here. You just have to go in and sign a couple documents. A pause. How much do you need?
$20,000.
Another pause. Was Ray even hearing him right?
That's a lot of money. I can pay it back within the year. Easy. This restaurant is a sure thing.
Can I think about it?
Yeah, sure, of course. But the restaurant equipment won't be around too long. I'd really need to get an answer from you by tomorrow.
But tomorrow, Christoph pushed Uncle Larry's cheap restaurant equipment out of Ray's mind. Before rehearsing again with the Baltimore Philharmonic, Ray had two more performances left. Christoph met Ray in his dressing room. It was a tiny cubicle, barely large enough to turn around in. A narrow counter with a lighted mirror took up all of one wall, and the other walls were gray corduroy. When Christoph sat next to him, Ray felt as if four people glared at each other in the tiny space. Ray and Christoph and their reflections, all sitting side by side by side.
The first thing you need, Christoph told him, is a signature. Something nice, something small, that will get your audience on your side.
Like what? Ray said, mystified. I play for them. That's what they're here for.
I would not expect you to understand. These subtleties are lost on people like you.
This was going to be fun, Ray thought. Only the first day and the first words out of Christoph's mouth were stupid and racist. But the racism didn't seem intentional. Christoph was just deeply ignorant and impossibly clueless.
What do you have in mind? Ray asked.
Your people are known for their jungle rhythms, no? We carefully choose the first piece you are to play. You come on stage, and you dance the first few minutes.
Ray was speechless. Are you nuts? I can't do that.
I would not have expected you could, Christoph said. Not dance, but something like dance. A nod to your African ancestry. You need something to make your own.
A nod to Ray's African ancestry? Seriously? Well, there's the bow I do at the end, Ray said, when I hold out the violin.
That comes too late. Can you start the performance by giving the audience something? A flower, perhaps? To a pretty girl?
You're a handsome man. Let's make the audience love you before you play a note.
So that night, when Ray appeared, he bowed like he always did, shook the conductor's hand, shook the concertmaster's hand, and then marched off the stage, down into the audience. He handed a long-stemmed pink rose to an older woman in her 60s. She blushed. The crowd exploded. Then, when he played the Brahms, he sensed immediately the difference. He was connecting with them more viscerally. They were rooting for him in a way that was beyond the music, but also because of the music. For the next month, he would put up with Christoph's oblivious racism. Ray could learn from him. The 5 million eyeballs watching the live-streaming Tchaikovsky competition awaited. Back at the hotel, he had 3 texts, 2 missed calls, and 2 emails from Uncle Larry.
"Sorry to keep bugging you, but I really need an answer," Uncle Larry said. "They're holding the equipment for me, and I need to get that loan signed."
"Uncle Larry, I can't," Ray finally said. "I wish I could, but I can't risk losing my violin. I have a bunch of gigs coming up, and I can try sending you more money then, okay?"
Larry's voice was soft and deflated.
"The equipment will be gone by then."
"I'm sure there'll be another shot, and at that point, we both will have saved more, okay?"
Larry disconnected the line without responding. Over the next few weeks, Christoph took apart Ray's performance. He didn't focus on the music, which Ray found difficult to understand. For Christoph, music was a show. He drilled into each section of Ray's repertoire, telling him to stand in one place at the beginning of a piece's movement with a yellow light on him, and then for the second movement to glide to the other side of the conductor under a blue light. Think of each musical element as a stage play. As the mood of the piece changes, so too does the lighting, your expression, your posture. They would arrive early to the concert hall, have elaborate discussions with the concertmaster and the lighting team.
"No, the lens for the blue is too small for the Mendelssohn. We need something twice this big. Or the left light bar only. Only. Are you deaf?"
Working with Christoph was a lesson not only in lighting design and showmanship, but in rudeness and bigotry. In the meantime, Ray's rejection of his uncle's get-rich-quick scheme didn't seem to dampen Uncle Larry's restaurant enthusiasm. A week later, he found the perfect spot for a late-night dinner club, and would Ray co-sign that loan? Every day or two, an email or text pinged on his phone from someone in his family. Uncle Thurston had a new girlfriend with expensive tastes, and they were really hoping to go to Bali for a vacation this August. Aunt Joyce's husband had decided to buy a shower door company that was going cheap. Everyone needs shower doors, don't they? Thankfully, his mother texted the least of any of them, and only when she didn't receive the money she'd expected. She kept a careful eye on his schedule, so if a payment didn't come into her account within 24 hours of his previous performance, sure enough, his phone would chime. "You forget about us." He gave what he could, but it wasn't enough. He wondered if it would ever be enough. Of all his family, he looked forward to hearing only from Aunt Rochelle. She never asked for money and was always enthusiastic, asking how he was doing. She, at least, was on his side. At the same time, it seemed, too, that the Marx family had disappeared. Kim Walk wrote them a vicious letter telling them to leave her client alone. But one afternoon, Kim called.
"When did you last check your email?"
I don't know, he said. "Yesterday."
"Why, what's going on?"
"They've lawyered up," she told him.
The air was suddenly too thin to breathe. He tried to take a breath and then take another, but nothing would enter his lungs.
"What do you mean?"
"The Marx family hired a lawyer. Check your email."
"Dear Miss Walk, I am writing on behalf of my clients, Andrea and Dante Marx, pursuant to the violin presently in possession of your client, Mr. Raekwon McMillan. Please be advised that Mr. and Ms. Marks, brother and sister, are direct descendants and statutory heirs of Thomas and Lobelia Marks of Summerlin Manor, Milledgeville, Georgia. The Marks family, originally Marcello, see Immigration Documents Attachment A, arrived from Piacenza, Italy, in or about 1793. In their possession was one Violino di Cremona, or violin from the city of Cremona. See Inventory of Summerlin Manor, 1806, Attachment B. This violin was the cherished possession of Thomas Marks and went missing sometime during or after December 1864. The Marks family has diligently sought its repossession ever since. Mr. McMillan has clearly indicated in media interviews, Attachments C and D, that his ancestor, Leon Marks, was at one time property of the Marks family, and that the violin has remained within his family's possession since Leon Marks either obtained or was granted freedom. Therefore, please be advised that it is my client's contention, pursuant to well-established case law, most recently upheld in Reef v. Nage, 175 AD 3D 107, 2017, as follows. The Marks family's original ownership of the violin is undisputed. Leon Marks unlawfully obtained possession of the violin. Because the initial transfer of the violin was involuntary, all subsequent transfers of the violin, i.e. to Mr. McMillan, are null and void, and Thomas and Lobelia Marks remain the true owners of the violin. The Marks family is not unsympathetic to Mr. McMillan's situation, however, and is willing to settle at an agreed-upon sum if I hear from you within the next 10 days. If I do not hear from you within the time frame set forth above, please be advised that my clients have authorized me to file suit in the relevant jurisdiction as necessary. Sincerely, Albert Bonavincenzo. He called Kim back.
They're not going away, he said.
It doesn't seem so, she agreed. They're willing to spend serious money to keep this going. I have to warn you that this is going to get expensive.
How expensive?
Not sure yet, but our firm will ask for a $30,000 retainer if they file suit.
$30,000, Ray thought. How could he come up with $30,000?
As he was trying to make his mouth work and respond to her, Kim went on.
There's one piece in the letter that sticks out to me. The violin went missing sometime during or after December 1864. That feels very precise, doesn't it? This was around when the Emancipation Proclamation was being issued. That was in 1863, and the 13th Amendment was ratified at the end of 1865. But I think if the violin went missing, and if they'd diligently sought its repossession, they'd have included some kind of documentation that shows this, wouldn't they?
So you think there's hope for me?
Again, too early to tell. Stolen art cases can get messy.
Okay, he said, not sure he understood. What's next?
If you agree, I'll write this lawyer a letter asking for more information. Let's see what we can uncover. Let's see if we can buy you some time before they file a lawsuit. If they file in North Carolina, we'll need to obtain co-counsel down there, and that will be even more expensive for you.
He closed his eyes. Somehow it was easier to not see the world right then. What should I do in the meantime?
Talk to your family, she said. See if you can get any further information on the violin's history.
Wait a minute, he said slowly. His tongue suddenly felt thick in his mouth, as if it were difficult to speak around. Hold on a sec. There might be something.
What do you mean?
Back when I was in high school, I found something up in my grandma's attic. He flashed back to that enormous attic and his systematic search. Buried in boxes under one of the eaves, a yellow dresser with round, shiny green draw handles like eyes. There was an envelope that had the name Leon Marks written on it. I took it downstairs and gave it to my grandma. I thought she'd want it.
What happened to it?
No idea.
Well, this is great news. Documentation might make the Markses go away forever, Kim said.
That night, Ray called Aunt Joyce. He seemed to remember that she was the keeper of family documents, and that his mom had called her the family historian. When she answered, he said, "I don't want to bug you too much, but I need a favor." Canned TV laughter roared in the background and then grew muted. She must have turned down the volume.
"Is everything okay? What do you need?"
"I'm trying to track down any letters or any documents about Pop-Pop and the fiddle. Do you have anything?"
"I don't think so,"
she said slowly.
"I have Mama's and Daddy's birth certificates and some letters and papers, I think. I don't think I have anything about Pop-Pop. I can look, though. What do you need it for?"
"It's really important. Anything you can find will help me. I think I saw an envelope when I was in Grandma's attic. I gave it to her and didn't see it again. It had the name Leon Marks written on it."
"Oh, okay. I'll look. Is everything okay?"
"These crazy people are threatening to sue me for the violin. They're saying that Pop-Pop stole it from their family, and that it really belongs to them."
"What? You have got to be kidding me."
"Yeah. So I need any type of documentation that proves it belongs to us."
"Wait. You're telling me the slave owner's family are saying that Pop-Pop stole the violin from them?"
Yeah. That's what I'm saying."
"That is totally fucked up,"
Aunt Joyce said firmly.
"Typical crazy white folks. I'll see what I can dig up. Mama used to keep a bunch of old papers in boxes. I haven't even opened them since she passed. I'll find you something."
A few minutes later, Ray hung up, feeling optimistic for the first time in days. His family, as defective and maladjusted as they were, was behind him. He was not alone. His mood continued to improve throughout that day and the next. So the following afternoon, when Christoph told him he needed a costume, Ray just went with it. A costume? Like what, a clown? By now he could keep a completely straight face, so Christoph never knew he was kidding. He just thought Ray was stupid, and Ray found that to be even funnier.
"No, not a clown," Christoph sniffed. "I would not imagine that you would understand this, but you need people to look at you more."
"They're already looking at me."
"A cape," Christoph said. "Black on the outside, and dark red velvet inside. Very dramatic."
"Yeah, for Dracula, maybe," Ray said. "Or for somebody who's 90. Not for me, though." They spent the next few days going around and around with costuming possibilities before deciding on black sequins for the tuxedo lapel and a colored tuxedo shirt instead of a white one. Christoph had tried to put Ray in ruffles, but that was seriously not happening.
"You'd look good in brighter colors," Christoph said.
Was it a compliment?
"How about your wearing a red tuxedo shirt?"
"If I were playing Carmen and I was the bull, maybe," Ray said.
"Yellow, then. Yellow would set off your skin color nicely."
Ray tried on a yellow tuxedo shirt, decided he looked like a pineapple. Eventually, they settled on Ray's suggestion of a pale pink to match the rose that he now handed to an audience member each night before the performance. Christoph thought the color was simply to match the rose. In truth, Ray's choice of color was a nod to Grandma Nora's housecoat, a private moment that only he appreciated. It was as if he were performing with her every night. Christoph's staginess was paying off. The crowds were huge. Most of the shows were selling out. Despite the crazy Marx family and his own family's general greediness, everything seemed to be getting better and better. And then he flew to Baton Rouge. Chapter 19. Baton Rouge, 6 months ago. In mid-November, he was booked to play a recital at Louisiana State University. He flew in and was enjoying the drive in his rented Toyota on a late autumn afternoon down a lazy southern highway. He blasted Eric B. and Rakim on high. He had an hour before he had to be there, and the GPS showed him only 20 minutes away. It was a Sunday evening, and the roads were pretty empty. He pulled off the highway and onto a divided road lined with fast food restaurants and big box stores. A mile on, the GPS alerted him that in 500 feet, he would need to make a left turn. He was in the right lane. Checking his mirrors, Ray put on his signal and turned left. A few minutes after, he noticed a police car behind him and began the universal prayer that all drivers intone when a police officer follows them.
Please let him pass me. Please let it not be me.
He wasn't speeding. He was wearing a seatbelt. He waited. Blue lights flickered behind him. Ray's pulse quickened. It's always nerve-wracking to be pulled over by police, he told himself. But he knew it was more than that. He was a black man in the Deep South, driving a nice car. He'd seen too many news reports of black men having awful encounters with police. No way, he thought. I haven't done anything wrong. Plus, he had a $10 million Strad sitting on the floor of the passenger seat. He was a big-time performer now. He'd explain everything calmly and be on his way. He pulled into the parking lot of a boarded-up convenience store. The sun was beginning to set. Hopefully, this wouldn't take too long. Maybe it was just a taillight. The police car sat behind him, lights flashing. No sign of the officer yet. He turned off the Eric B. and Rakim, put both hands clearly visible on the steering wheel. The police car door opened. One booted foot touched the ground.
Step outside your vehicle.
The guy was using a bullhorn.
You, step out of the vehicle now. Are you deaf? Do it now.
Ray's heart was hammering. He got out of the car, both hands in the air. Yeah, sure, white cops beat black guys up or shot them, but he was a college grad on his way to a classical music performance. That kind of thing couldn't happen to him. He'd just stay calm and do whatever the cop asked him to do. Sweat slid cold down his back.
Turn around and keep your hands up.
Ray turned around, kept his hands up. Every movement was slow, deliberate, as if in a vat of engine oil. Boots crunched closer. The snout of a gun wavered into view. Had the guy actually drawn his gun? On Ray?
Get down on the ground. On your knees.
Ray's heart threatened to pound out of his chest. The asphalt pebbles dug into his knees as he slowly lowered himself. He wanted to speak, but couldn't.
Show me your ID.
It's in my wallet. I'm going to reach into my back pocket and pull it out.
He moved his right hand to his rear pocket. The wallet wasn't there. Damn, it was in the center console.
It's in my car, officer. In the middle, between the seats.
Stay where you are. You make one move, and I'll blow your fucking head off.
The cop looked to be in his late 40s, a meaty blonde man with a reddened face, scraggly goatee, and receding hair barely visible beneath his deputy's hat. His gut hung over a wide black belt. When he bent through the front door, his shirt rolled up, revealing a white back covered in coarse hair. He stood up, holding Ray's wallet. He pulled out the driver's license, stared at it, put it back. The name on his badge, E. Bouquet. Officer Bouquet looked at the front passenger seat.
Well, well, well. What do we have here?
He reached for the violin case.
No, that's my... Shut the fuck up!
Bouquet pointed his gun at Ray's forehead. Ray bit the inside of his cheek. The muzzle of the gun was the blackest color ever. The metal around it gleamed with an oily sheen. He'd never been this close to a gun before. Officer Bouquet pulled the case out of the car, fumbling and dropping it on the ground. Reflexively, Ray lunged forward.
Officer, please, that's a very expensive...
The gun came back up into his face.
Keep your mouth shut. Stand up. Hands behind your back.
Ray stood, a hand pressed between his shoulder blades, and then a jingle, and the cool metal of handcuffs embraced his wrists, rattled shut.
Wait. What did I do?
Didn't I tell you to shut up?
He slammed Ray's head against the hood of the car. Ray struggled to keep his balance, his left leg stepping back onto the man's foot.
Now I got you for assaulting an officer.
I didn't do anything. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step on you. I need to get to LSU. I'm doing a performance there at...
The only place you are going is to the county lockup, boy.
Stolen property and assaulting an officer. Officer Bouquet turned him around. The officer's blonde goatee, in need of trimming, glistened with sweat.
Wait, officer. You need to call LSU. My name is...
You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law.
Where was his violin?
He thought suddenly of Grandma Nora, felt unaccountably that he was failing her. Would he live to see the morning? He closed his eyes, opened them, tried to take a breath, but his lungs couldn't grab air. Of course he'd live to see tomorrow. Of course he would. He'd done everything right. He hadn't broken any laws. He was being polite and respectful. This was nothing more than a stupid misunderstanding. With a phone call, it would all be sorted out.
Officer, can you please just call LSU's music department?
Watch your head, boy.
Ray was in the back seat. The violin was in the passenger seat.
Where were his car keys? Officer, please. What did I do?
Do me a favor and shut up.
But I've got to get to LSU. I'm supposed to be playing a recital there and...
Officer Bouquet slammed on the brakes, throwing Ray forward. Ray bashed his nose on the back of the passenger seat.
Oops, you should have buckled up.
Last warning. Ray's eyes stung with pain. Blood slid down his face, dripped off his chin. His pants were spattered. With his hands behind his back, he couldn't wipe at it. He rubbed at the blood with his shoulder, but that didn't help. How could he play now? He said nothing further. Eventually, the blood stopped flowing, caking his chin. 15 minutes later, they pulled up in front of a brick-fronted police station. Inside, Bouquet, carrying the violin case, said to the clerk,
"Book this one for an illegal lane change and assaulting an officer."
The violin disappeared into a back room.
Hey, I'm supposed to get a phone call.
Ray's phone was still in the rental. Nobody knew where he was. Another cop grabbed him by the elbow, took him into a back room with file cabinets, paper everywhere, and some desks and desk chairs. On the walls were wanted posters. The floor was a grimy yellow.
"Give me your right hand," the man said.
He was short, with a shaved head and muscles that bulged beneath his shirt. His thin mustache made him look like former military.
"Could someone please tell me what's going on? Am I being arrested?"
"You got it, genius."
The officer took Ray's hand and rolled each finger in ink, pressed each tip onto cardboard.
"Why am I being arrested? Is there someone I can talk to? Am I supposed to get a phone call?"
"Shut up and give me your other hand."
"My name is Ray McMillan, and I don't care if you're Ray Charles. Shut up."
Mustache walked him to a holding cell that smelled like pee and cleaning solvent. Where was the violin? He turned to look for it, but a hand between his shoulder blades pushed him through the doorway. On the bench sat an older white man in a tattered tank top. The ripe aroma of at least 4 types of liquor bathed the air.
"I'm late for a recital at LSU. Look, I just need to call LSU's music department and they'll straighten all this out."
Mustache had already strolled off.
"Ha, yeah. That's all it takes, his cellmate said. If a cop says you did it, you did it. May as well settle in.
Oh, my God. I can't believe this.
Ray sat down as far away from the stench as he could, but he realized he wasn't much better. The entire front of his shirt was covered in blood and sweat. His violin could be anywhere right now. Where had they taken it? He tried to remember the details of the insurance policy. How could he live with himself if something happened to it? 5 hours later, near midnight, he was allowed to make a call from the police station's phone. Janice's was the only number he knew by heart. She answered on the first ring. LSU had called Kristoff, who had eventually called her. At least he was safe, she told him. It would all be okay. She'd make some calls, wake up the president of LSU if need be. Sit tight. Around 2 in the morning, Mustache came for Ray. By then, his cellmate had taken over almost the whole bench and was snoring and drooling inches from Ray's leg. Ray stood up.
Well, boy, guess you have some friends somewhere.
He led Ray back, more gently now, to the front desk where 2 people were waiting for him. An overweight woman in khakis and a sagging pink blouse, and a young heavyset kid with bad acne and a worse haircut. Pink Blouse ran to him as soon as he appeared.
Mr. McMillan, I'm Monica DeLong. I'm the Dean of Music at LSU, and I can't begin to tell you how sorry I am.
I need my violin, Ray told her. They took it from me.
The violin reappeared. He examined it carefully. It seemed fine. He didn't look back as he left. Professor DeLong led him to her Audi, the student following behind. They dropped the student off to pick up Ray's car, but she'd take Ray right now to his hotel so he could get cleaned up and get some rest. His clothes and car would be there in no time. She couldn't stop apologizing. He barely spoke, just hugged the violin case tightly. Suddenly, he was exhausted. He felt as if the blood had stopped moving in his veins. Officer E. Bouquet, all those cops, had treated him like he'd murdered the Pope. Why did it keep happening? He knew the answer, of course. Later, after the check-in and the shower and the delivery of his suitcase and the throwing away of the clothes he'd been wearing, and the wrapping of himself in the thick white terry cloth of the Best Western's bathrobe, he called Janice again. After reassuring her that he was fine and thanking her profusely for helping free him, he told her what he wanted to happen next. Later that morning, at 11 a.m., Ray entered the conference room of the Best Western in West Baton Rouge Parish. Janice had flown in earlier and now sat in the front row. There were 12 or so people in the room, and flashbulbs were going off as he threaded his way to the podium, unfolded the paper he'd printed out an hour ago, and leaned into the microphone.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to begin by offering my sincerest apologies to everyone who expected to see me at last night's recital. I never made it to the recital hall at LSU. While I was on my way, I was pulled over by Sergeant Ezra Bouquet of the Baton Rouge Police Department. That's B-O-C-Q-U-E-T-E-Z-R-A. He made me get out of my car and get on my knees with his gun pointed at my head because I made an illegal lane change. I was demeaned, demoralized, and treated like a criminal as I was taken to jail in handcuffs because I changed lanes. The people of Baton Rouge are some of the luckiest people on earth to have policing like this. I accept full responsibility for signaling and making a left turn from a right lane. I truly hope that you good people of this city let your police department know how you feel about it as well. Questions? The room erupted. Ray hadn't realized, but Christoph had come after all. He hadn't even reached out to Ray ahead of time. Now he leaned against the back wall, expressionless.
Are you saying the police department is racist? One reporter asked.
I'm not saying anything of the kind, Ray said.
Have you faced racial discrimination before? Asked another.
Constantly, Ray said.
Did you provoke the officer in any way?
No, Ray said.
Do you feel you are owed an apology?
What will you do now?
Do you have any plans to return to Baton Rouge?
Ray answered the last question.
I can say with all certainty that I will never return to the city of Baton Rouge under any circumstances.
20 minutes later, he thanked the reporters for coming and left. Janice met him outside.
Well, he asked her. You were wonderful.
Christoph strolled up as they were getting into a town car.
You certainly messed this up. You should have been apologetic to all the people that paid to see your Stradivarius. This is going to take some serious damage control.
Janice opened her mouth to speak, but Ray held up his hand. He leaned forward and looked up at Christoph, who was about to get into the passenger seat.
Christoph, he said,
you're a joke. You are a complete and total joke. How I've managed to tolerate you as long as I have is a miracle. I'll pay for the rest of this month and a one-way plane ticket back to D.C. In other words, your sorry whack ass is fired, bro.
Christoph said nothing for a moment, his mouth working.
You can't fire me, you arrogant son of a bitch.
He pointed at Ray.
You'll never make it as a soloist. You can't play your way out of a paper bag. That violin is the only reason you are even in my presence.
You're right, Christoph. Never mind about the plane ticket. Let's go. As they drove off, he and Janice burst into laughter.
You know what? Ray said. That really felt good. Today is a new day. I think I just became a man.
Welcome to manhood, kid,
Janice told him. And my first job as a man is to apologize to you.
You have nothing to...
Yes, I do. I'm sorry. I was trying to figure out how to be a better showman, to have a leg up for the Tchaikovsky competition, and I thought I needed someone like Christoph to teach me. I think all I learned is that I just have to trust my gut and do what I do. And that means play.
For the record, Janice answered, I think it was smart of you to want to stretch your wings. I'll help you find other teachers, people who I think will be a better fit than Christoph.
The media story lasted for several days, and interviews continued to pour in as an investigation of the Baton Rouge Police Department followed. Months ago, Ray had been a curiosity, a black kid with a priceless instrument. Now the media was interested in him because he was becoming a seasoned, strong performer who was regularly headlining sold-out shows across the East Coast, whose career was on the verge of taking off. It was no longer just the Strad, either. It was Ray himself who drew them. He was handsome and well-spoken. The media loved him. When he performed, the energy thrummed through him, so bright that he thought sometimes he would burn himself out with excitement. And then the next shoe dropped. This one and another email labeled urgent from Aunt Rochelle, who had never asked him for money.
Ray, I'm sorry to be the one to tell you this, but my crazy brothers and sisters are officially suing you for Mama's violin. They are worried about the other lawsuit, and they think you'll lose the violin, so they want to get it first. When you get an official letter from a law firm, that's what it's about. I want no part in it. I'm sorry this is happening, sugar. Good luck with your performances. Love, Rochelle.
Thank you. Part 5. Starstruck.